The latest news and analysis is brought to you every Monday to Thursday. Live in the Israel Update with Anthony Reich, only on Chai FM.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov, Howard. Good, thank you. How are you guys doing today?
Yes, excellent. Thank you indeed. Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday decided not to renew the mandate of the International Observer Force in Hebron. I mean, that's clearly quite a significant move. First of all, what is the International Observer Force in Hebron?
So it's actually known as the Temporary International Presence in Hebron. And goes under the letter TIPH, because we always have to have three or four letter acronyms for everything. So it's commonly known as TIPH, being the Temporary International Presence in Hebron. And it's been temporary for 22 years, since 1997. And in fact, it goes back a little bit further than that, because initially, the force was established in 1994, and this was in the wake of the massacre that took place in the Marot HaMachpelah, in the Cave of the Patriarchs, in which 29 Palestinians were killed. That was back in February of 1994. And when the UN Security Council condemned the massacre and called for a temporary international presence in Hebron, in fact, one was established, and it was established including people from Italy, Denmark, and Norway, who effectively provided observers to form this temporary international presence in Hebron. And it operated only just for a short period of time, from May until August of that year, at which time it lapsed. And after that, it was then reestablished in 1995 after the signing of the Oslo Agreement, which called for a partial redeployment of Israeli forces in Hebron, other places as well. And then this temporary international presence was again reestablished. This time, it was just only with Norwegian members. And again, it was only for a relatively short period of time, until 1997, when it was set up for a third and final time, which has continued until the present day. And the observers come from Norway, Italy, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, and Turkey. So those are the countries that make up this observer force. And it operates for a period of 3 months and then gets renewed every kind of 3 months. And it's been renewed every 3 months for the last 22 years. Every 3 months, the Israeli government and indeed the Palestinian Authority need to reinforce, renew their commitment to this presence in Hebron until yesterday. And yesterday it was finally decided that the Prime Minister, that he would not want to renew it any longer. And it's an interesting time that he's chosen for this, because, you know, when we look back over the 22 years, there have been so many different incidents that have happened. There were incidents involving members of the observer force actually slapping Israeli children. The observer force has been constantly accused of not being impartial in disagreements between Israelis and Palestinians in the city of Hebron. There have been a lot of criticisms about how they've operated. There's been this notion of neutrality as opposed to impartiality. And the idea is, according to someone who's been involved in the force, that they're not expected to be neutral, but they are expected to be impartial. And the question is whether they've actually been impartial. They've certainly not been welcomed by the Jewish presence in Hebron at all. The people who live, the Jews who live in Hebron, have felt that, you know, having that observer force there is really not very helpful. And when you have a look at, you know, the types of incidents, the things that they're supposed to cover, then you can see that there is certainly kind of an imbalance. You know, there's the 4 points about the activities that they're supposed to cover, which include developing reports. They're supposed to report on things. They're not supposed to get involved, but they're supposed to report on things. And the things that they're supposed to report on are damages to private property caused by the IDF or Israeli settlers, a prolonged ID checks or verbal and physical harassment by IDF personnel, other breaches of international human rights standards, and breaches of rules applicable to Hebron, such as the interim agreement or Hebron protocol. So you can see that 2 out of those 4 points really pertain to breaches by the IDF and or Israeli settlers. The third is other breaches of international human rights standards, whatever that might mean, which could potentially pertain to both Israelis and Palestinians living in that area of Hebron, and breaches of the rules, which also pertains to both of them, except that I'm not really sure exactly what these rules are. So there seems to be an imbalance from the outset in terms of the activities that they're required to report on. So that really is the history of this particular presence in Hebron, so-called temporary, but now really temporary, because after 22 years, as I say, the Prime Minister has decided that Israel's had enough of it and he's not agreeing to renew their mandate any longer.
What are the consequences of not renewing the mandate? What does it actually mean now?
Well, I think that the message comes in a number of different ways. I think, first of all, there are some people who say this is an election ploy, because the Prime Minister is trying to gain support from certain constituencies around Israel, and one of those constituencies is one which does not support the deployment of this particular force. So this will be a way of him getting support from certain people who have a strong feeling against the presence of this force in Hebron. Others are saying that this is clearly a statement against cooperation with the Palestinian Authority, because this particular force was really one which required some cooperation, in the sense that both the Palestinians and the Israelis needed to be involved in agreeing to extend its mandate every 3 months. There are others who are saying that, you know, this might be something linked to what the Americans are proposing, or may propose ultimately after the election, as part of their peace plan, which has been so much advertised and so little known about. So this might be, you know, another message that is being sent out. But it's quite a strong message, and it's a strong statement, because it's a breaking of the status quo, which has existed for 22 years in Hebron. And Hebron is a highly volatile area, and potentially, you know, things could break out there very, very easily. And bearing in mind that the caves of the patriarchs, the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, which is in the city of Kir Hebron, and which is very carefully marshaled to allow both Jewish and Muslim worshippers to attend there at different times of the day in order to keep the peace. You know, the question is whether this potentially has an implication about how things are going to be managed around the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, and whether that status quo might be interrupted as a result of the Prime Minister's decision not to renew this particular force.
And, of course, always a very, very volatile area. And I don't know if any of our listeners have been to the Cave of the Patriarchs. I have, my own experience in some ways is that I find it more moving than I even do the Kotel. I don't know what it is about, Ma'arat HaMachpelah, but, the Cave of the Patriarchs, that I find it an incredibly, incredibly emotionally and spiritually powerful place to be.
I think that, you know, the thing about that particular location is that it has a physical presence rather than a purely spiritual one.
Where
we come to the Kotel, I mean, we know that that was the site of the temple. The temple was built there from a spiritual point of view. In other words, you know, from the beliefs that we have about that particular location, the things that we've read in the Torah about the various events that happened during those days at that particular location, Har Moriah, Mount Moriah. Whereas the Caves of the Machpelah, we know that is the physical burial place of so many of Judaism's ancestors, that it has a very physical element to it, which obviously has a spiritual side to it as well.
Absolutely. This is an incredible story that I've started to see pop up all over the place. And I always view it with some form of skepticism. And so I'd like to actually just explore this a little bit more with you. A team of Israeli scientists have claimed to have found a complete cure for cancer. Can this be believed after so many have claimed to have found a cure?
I am skeptical, as I always am about these things. So I've read so many articles about cures for cancer and treatments for cancer. And, you know, this is, you know, because so many people die from cancer, this is really the, you know, the ultimate in terms of, you know, finding cure for an illness which really affects so many different people across so many societies in so many ways. And yet, this team from an incubator, which is based in the Weizmann Science Park in Rehovot, has made a very bold claim. And the claim is a quote that was made by one Dan Aridor, who is one of the members of this, one of the scientists in this team. And he's just said the following: we believe we will offer in a year's time a complete cure for cancer. That's what he said.
That's a very big statement, and it's not coming from a non-reputable organization.
Absolutely. I mean, this is somebody who would be quite cautious, I would think, about making such far-reaching claims. And then he went on to say the following. He said, our cancer cure will be effective from day one, will last a duration of a few weeks, and will have no or minimal side effects at a much lower cost than most other treatments on the market. Our solution will be both generic and personal. I mean, he's making huge statements here about what they're going to be delivering in terms of what the time frame is, how it's going to be delivered, what the effect is going to be, and how much it's going to cost. And so this is, I think that this is a massive statement. And I think that this is somebody who's probably smart enough to understand that making a statement like this is very, very significant, and you need to be cautious before you actually open your mouth to say things like this. There is quite a lot of information that has been published from a scientific point of view about exactly what this treatment is. It's something that they call mutato multi-target toxin. I don't really understand much about all of this. Fortunately, my training is not in the medical field, but apparently it's essentially on the scale of a cancer antibiotic. That's what they're calling it. A disruption technology of the highest order. So there's a lot of high expectations which are being built by all of these statements. It's going to be very interesting to really see over the next year whether they can deliver this, because I'm going to be watching this one very carefully, as much as I'm skeptical about all of these fantastic claims about cures for all types of diseases. I mean, many Israeli scientists have been talking about finding cures and effective treatments for Alzheimer's and many other diseases. But this one is really a massive statement, and it's hitting the front pages everywhere. And I'm certainly going to be watching this with a great deal of interest to see whether this can be delivered or not.
Is this a private, you said it was discovered by which organization?
It's a team, which is, a company actually, which is called Accelerated Evolution Biotechnology.
Are they listed? Founded in, I mean, can we get shares, or is it, or has it really had its run? Asking for a friend.
I've never heard of these guys before. I have to be honest and say to you, and I'm not sure that it's a listed company. I can probably check it out.
I think we might be too late for the exponential growth.
Just behind the curve.
Yes, it could be. Yes.
They're apparently been going since the year 2000 as part of some sort of an incubator involved in the Weizmann Science Park out in Rehovot. I think if this is real, this is something unbelievable.
Wow. And the word unbelievable doesn't even do it justice, because this changes the whole face of the world in every aspect.
Absolutely.
Of course, it will be always interesting to hear what, BDS's view on it and how they would continue with that campaign. But look, I don't think those issues have ever really allowed it to stand in their way. We've got 2 minutes. Just a quick one I wanted to ask you. Special representatives have been sent by Russian President Putin to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel today. What are they, what's likely to be conveyed here by the special representative?
The two members of this particular team, the one is the Russian President's Special Envoy for Syria, Alexander Lavrentiev. And also the other member of the team is the Russian Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sergei Vershudin. And they've come along to talk not only to Prime Minister Netanyahu, but indeed yesterday they held talks with members of Israel's foreign ministry. And one only assumes that it's all about Syria, given that we have the Syrian special envoy as one of the members of this particular delegation coming out to seemingly send a clear message to Israel. And so I think that this is really all about events that have been going on in Syria. I think it's all related to the proposed U.S. pullout of troops from Syria, which doesn't seem to be happening at the moment, even though President Trump was very, very firm in saying that he would pull his troops out. Then he decided that he would take a little bit longer to pull them out. And now there's even talk of keeping some American troops in Syria. So we're not quite sure exactly where all of that stands. But I think that the Russians have been somewhat humiliated in Syria, with Israel attacking at will whenever it wishes to against targets in Syria, despite the fact that the Russians are clearly on the ground in Syria. They have their airplanes in the air, and also they have Russian anti-missile systems, which don't seem to have been fully deployed yet. But Israel doesn't seem to care about this. And Israel is just going about really humiliating the Russian presence in Syria. And so I just wonder whether this particular delegation is not coming to somehow try to rescue some of Russia's reputation for what's going on in Syria at the moment. There are, of course, people in Israel who are saying the fact that the Russian president has sent these people here is a bad sign, that this is really not what we would like right now. I guess we probably will hear more once the meeting with the prime minister has taken place later today.
And hopefully we'll follow that up with you tomorrow morning at the usual time.